Let's stay on that, Starlink, of course, that's one of Elon Musk's sort of great contributions to the world, as is, of course, space exploration, right? And but I want to talk to you about EVs. I know you're an EV guy.
As are you.
As am I. And I've been driving EVs for a long time. I started with a little Nissan Leaf, and it had a couple hundred kilometers. And to be quite honest with you, it was an ideal car for Prince Edward Island. I'm not sure why I ever got rid of it, to be honest with you. What is your take on EVs right now?
It's a funny, situation. So we've got government promoting alternate energy, green energy, heat pumps, electric vehicles. At the same time, they're suggesting that we need a carbon-based fuel to create the energy that we've now driven demand through. So energy is a part of it. I think cost is a part of it. And I think geopolitical sort of tension. So you look at what Trump's done in the States, he's pretty much canceled electric vehicle incentives, and he wants to get back to mining coal, not moving to the future. China absolutely have 100% moved to electric vehicle, and even Elon Musk says we can't compete with Chinese. So I guess my perception is EVs shouldn't go away. They're an option and an alternative, in some cases an expensive option. But if Carney's successful in bringing in the low-cost BYD vehicles from China, they're going to be more accessible at a $40,000 vehicle.
What do you think of that? I mean, there's a counterpoint to that, that if China starts bringing, which are heavily subsidized EVs, right?
Absolutely.
If they start dumping those into our market,
they're going to kill the domestic auto sector.
Right. And is that a good thing?
Well, it's a thing. I guess auto manufacturers have to be able to adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been acknowledged, and I've heard this stat before, including European manufacturers who are very good auto, you know, makers for a couple hundred years, they may not survive this onslaught. So the Japanese, the Koreans, the Europeans, for certain, the American manufacturers are going to be really affected. And when you look at the infrastructure that these legacy companies, ICE vehicle manufacturers, have installed, that's everything from the service centers and the employment that goes with it to the salespeople, administrative. Like, there's a lot of employment that accompanies these industries. To have that disrupted by an external manufacturer who is subsidized, mm-hmm. who may be having technologies deployed within our country we might not want or know what they are, it's a concern. And it's a sovereignty and maybe a security concern. But I guess it comes down to the natural selection. And if you're not manufacturing at a level that makes it affordable, maybe your system's broken.
Right, yeah. I mean, they're manufacturing completely automated, pretty much.
And dark factories.
Yeah, they're just recently on the news. I mean, one vehicle every 56 seconds, 24 hours a day,
right.
with minimal sort of human interaction. Yeah. It's hard to compete with that, particularly if you're heavily subsidized. My concern might be a little deeper than that, and that is, if we lose the skill set to manufacture, that's got sort of carry-on effects, right? And maybe I'm a Luddite on this thing, but I don't often think I am, but maybe it's more of a move towards an automated plant as opposed to, and I think we're moving in that direction, so it's not about sort of the dumping these vehicles in, but us getting a little bit more clever around how we automate the manufacturing industry.
And there's a lot of employment loss from that too.
So that and creation, right?
Yeah.
And creation. There's one thing that is sticking on the auto industry, and I'd love your opinion on this, but you know, many people purchase cars every day, and sometimes it is a clunky experience.
Oh.
It is not easy. It blows my mind that this system still exists today.
The haggling, the conversation.
Right. I bought an electric vehicle not so many years ago on my phone.
Right.
6 weeks later, it arrived in my driveway.
Yes.
I had no interaction with anybody.
And for you, you're not a social person. You probably prefer that.
I
don't want interaction with humans.
But I mean, like, I don't understand. Like,
that's how the industry's moved to.
But if you look, but there's still car dealerships.
Yeah.
They're still, and
they're still buying. People are buying.
And people are still buying in that.
Yeah.
But even a nice vehicle, you don't have to go through that method to buy it.
And if you look at the dealership lots, to their credit, they don't have to have investment tied up to have all these vehicles in different colors and different styles. You can select it online. Sometimes the consumer knows more about the product than the salesperson.
Right.
You can select it order it, wait for it to come in. But I think your comment on manufacturing change is in kind of interesting and timely, because what's happening in the U.S., the current administration is trying to repatriate lost manufacturing jobs. Mm-hmm. And they're forcing kind of square pegs into round holes by making Apple manufacture, theoretically, iPhones, which right. they can't do. People can't, you can't migrate that kind of technology and, you know, at least affordably, you can't do it. So once that manufacturing capability is lost, if it's not deployed, you don't have it for other, maybe you need it in wartime.
Well, that's exactly, I mean, well, that's always been sort of the big concern around if you lose that ability to manufacture, which the automotive sector has, and during the Second World War, a lot of those plants were retooled, and that's really how the Americans were able to sort of launch into the Second World War with such success, is because they were able to do that. If you lose that, but I would argue maybe the counter argument is that it's not losing it, it's just rejigging the way people work, right? Is that future of work and automation, or how all that comes in?
As long as it doesn't happen so abruptly that the people can't adapt.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem. These transformational technological changes occur so quickly that generally people can't adapt. Everything moves so quick. So I think it needs more policy consideration, and government needs to be a little bit more proactive. And you're right, once that manufacturing technology is gone, it's gone.
You know, and as again, yesterday, I learned a lot about sort of NASA and their inner workings. And one statistic I heard yesterday was that in the 60s, they were spending somewhere around $40 billion annually on the NASA program. That was in the 60s. That's a lot of money, right?
That's a lot of money.
Those were big numbers back then, right? We use that now as sort of billion here, billion there. Sooner or later, we're going to be talking big money. But NASA is now only funded at $24 billion. So it's actually half the budget so many years later, but they're heavily relying
on private sector.
Private sector.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, that's a good thing, right? You get that collaboration now between sort of private sector, government, and obviously in the case of NASA and space exploration, there's a lot of academic conversation. So you got that sort of perfect collaboration, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think we see that enough here on the island with that sort of perfect collaboration between those partners.
And you've been a big advocate on this for many years. You've seen the success and the benefit of it, but you're right.
Yeah.
There's silos.
Mm-hmm.
And government is an impenetrable silo,
right.
Probably because they're fearful of industry. Maybe there's an aptitude, misalignment, but they are not, in my observation, very warm at industry being part of their conversation. They rather dictate.
You know, and we often talk about the defense sector. It's a bit of a sweet spot for me. But I recall 10 years ago, and maybe even less, there was always this wall between the Department of Defense and industry.
Right.
They were almost seen as industry was trying to get something, or
the department, as they probably are. That's their mandate.
But I want to tell you that wall has dropped. The collaboration between industry and the Department of Defense right now is a beautiful one. It's a very porous conversation. In fact, just this week in Ottawa will be what they call the Canadian Armed Forces Outlooks.
Okay.
And this is where the Army, Navy, and Air Force will stand before industry one day each, and they will go over every program they're working on.
That's uniquely transparent.
It's incredible, right?
Right?
And all the industry players will be in the room, and at the end of it, they'll give them all printouts to say, here's what we're focusing on, here's what we're doing, how can you help? Like, that is the type of collaboration that a provincial government needs to do.
And you look at the challenges that our provincial government have, and we'll talk about many of those here with Islanders, I'm sure, but if they don't look at ways to get input and expertise and perspective and thought leadership from those that might have that, it's not always residing within the silos of government. They got to reach out. That's a great example. It would be perfect to see government try that maybe with healthcare.
Right.
Maybe there's people who know more about parts of healthcare, like narrow parts that they're specialists in, than the bureaucrats.
100% virtual healthcare. I mean, there's companies out there that specialize in virtual healthcare, and they've done it for many, many years around the globe.
Right.
What makes us think that we're so different, that our solution is so unique, right? It's not. And so, but to have those people in the room at the table as opposed to responding to an RFP, hoping they get it right. Well, it's just a broken system,
that it takes to manage one of those processes. Business, unless you're getting government money, it's hard to withstand the torture and the time and the cost to wait for execution.
Right.
So an RFP with the federal government is probably like a multi-year process.
Sometimes it can be many years.
You can do that.
And it takes many people to respond to the RFP. So it's very difficult for any business to only rely on that, because it's just too up and down. And if you miss it, or if there's complaints and you get stalled by a year, you still have an incredible burn rate with salary and stuff. So, you know, there's cases where many companies have almost gone bankrupt in the process of applying for federal government contracts. And even worse, when they get the contract,
can you execute?
Well, can you execute it? But can you execute it on the government's pay terms?
Right.
Like if they've got a lengthy period to pay you and you've got a heavy burn rate. Shipbuilding is a great example of that, right? Shipbuilding is a great, you can imagine the staff it takes to build a ship, right?
It's the raw material cost.
Exactly. And if the government is not paying you sort of on a 90-day cycle or even more, think about that. You've got to sort of carry an entire workforce, which is huge.
And finance that. Yep. So unless government want a half a ship, they probably have to go. So let's look at what's happening provincially with the procurement process. And I'll give some credit to Minister Jill Burridge, who actually had a number of people that do procurement with the province to speak to them and get a better sense for what the issues are. And is the process working well? Are there areas of improvement? And I haven't seen that type of engagement with government probably ever in my limited career. But, you know, I hope that the engagement was with intention and to be acted upon. I believe it probably will be. But the fact that they reached out to people from different sectors to get feedback on the procurement process, one of the things that came out was speed.
Right.
Because you're right, people can't afford to wait for lengthy procurement.
Yeah. I've often wondered why in a province like Prince Edward Island, why we don't sort of try to bring all these conversations together more. Like healthcare is a great one, or housing, right? I often think about these big issues, and you've got a university sitting, I don't want to say idle, but certainly slower in the summer.
Yeah.
What an opportunity to sort of host events where you bring in, you know, many hundreds of people and say, right, the topic today is housing and we want all your voices. We want solutions come out of this, right? And incentivize people to give those solutions and sort of work through it with them. And to me, it just seems like with such a small population and such a small geography, while our problems seem large, it seems to me we can bring all these people into a conversation.
We should be nimble enough to do that. And probably at the university, I mean, there's sessional lecturers and people who take a session off, but there's still academics there doing research.
Yep.
And I think that's the maybe underutilized opportunity that could be tapped.
Yeah, and I think that to me, like if I were to wave a magic wand and I were to say, like, these are some of the things that I would do if I were premier, I would do things like that. I would try to get as innovative as possible with the people around me and say, okay, let's all get in a room and let's whiteboard this. The other thing that I always find fascinating about Prince Edward Island, when we face a problem, we try to do things the same way we've always done it. COVID was a great example of that to me.
And it could have been a better opportunity to pivot and deconstruct some of those.
Yeah. In COVID, we tried to face this threat, really, the same way we always did business, with standard departments and standard response mechanisms. And I remember having conversations with Heather Morrison at the time, and I said, Heather, this needs to be set up like we're in a war. We need a war.
It was a war, right?
We need to set up a war room where we can deal with problems 24/7, 7 days a week, and bang through them one by one. Putting them through the traditional methods of government is not going to work.
Yeah.
And it didn't, you know, in many cases it didn't work. People were frustrated. People felt their voices weren't being heard. I just felt like everything should have been run out of an operations room,
right?
And solve problems as they came in and sort of keep ahead of it.
And probably the chief medical officer's, you know,
she did a good job, by the way.
Yeah, and that probably was managed like a war room. The problem is we still had political intervention.
Right.
And my biggest regret of that period, regardless of what your position was on the virus and the impacts on the economy and people and lives, the biggest regret is that as soon as that crisis was over, perceived or real, we went back to our old ways.
Right.
When we had the opportunity to really change, but for whatever reason, probably political will, we just said, okay, thankfully that's over. We survived a little hiccup. Actually, didn't have to do a whole lot for 2 years. Now we got to get back to everything we're doing before, which is probably wrong. So we had the chance to completely transform.
Right.
We did.
It's interesting, right, that we're not alone in that. I look at that problem over and over again, whether it's in sort of recruiting for something, whatever it might be. We pour it on, meet what we need, and then stop.
Right.
We don't keep the effort going, right? And to me, things like recruiting, things like shipbuilding, and all of those big things and that we need to do as a country, it has to be seen as a continuum. We need to keep the pressure on always. It's not turning the switch on and off, because there's skill sets required to do all those things. I'm always fascinated when we take our foot off the pedal, mm-hmm. and then we have to sort of reinvent it all 10 years later.
Right. And as soon as you take your foot off the pedal, you coast. And,
yeah.
You know, we get accustomed to coasting, and certainly, you know, it's easier for politicians
right.
to coast.
Any callers?
No, I just was going to ask our back office if there's any comments on our Facebook Live site, let us know. We do have viewers, and it's great. Reminder again, the caller number, if you do want to reach out, it's 902-500-500-2464. So 500-2464. We're delighted to take your calls about any issues, and we're talking at a pretty high level. We will get down to the grassroots level. We can pivot to any area. If you want to put a comment in Facebook, we'll sort of pivot to that and start a conversation. But the conversation is really only live and active if we hear from you. So
yep.
That's what we want. What's in the minds of Islanders?
I agree. I'm going to ask you one that, we'll see where this one goes.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Okay. Mark Carney, how do you think he's doing?
You know what? So I would not have been a advocate of Mark Carney during the election campaign. I would say he's probably the leader we need for the environment that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of political or partisanship, some of the things he's doing to diversify the economy, I like to see the conversation on removing provincial barriers. And, really since Confederation, the whole East-West dialogue on transportation of goods, because we're inefficient as a country.
Mm-hmm.
We want to go north-south because that's where the population and the economy is. We can't reliably do that. And maybe we never will be able to again. We have to rely interprovincially, not large enough an economy to prosper fully. But what Mark is doing, or Mr. Carney, or Prime Minister Carney, is kind of building on, and I'll give Stephen Harper credit too, because he did open up a lot of new partnerships globally. But Mark Carney and his government, very actively, they've acknowledged, and I think they continue to try to work through the issues with the constraints on the U.S. tariffs. But look, he's opened up China, a dormant economy, the largest economy in the world. They're opening up Asia.
Mm-hmm.
They are having conversations in Europe. And these alliances that have not been as active because we've been so complacent with our southern border are now getting a rejuvenation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's to his credit specifically. He's an economist. He's a brilliant man. He's got a tremendous track record, in my opinion, from Goldman Sachs to the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England, and back to maybe provide a service with his acumen. He certainly has that. The key is, can industry and businesses, and particularly PI businesses, tag on to that opportunity? And can we get into the European conversations? You look at what Prime Minister President Trump is doing. He's breaking down the NATO alliance.
Right.
And he's gone in and created a conflict, regardless of what you think of that. And I know that there's probably great rationale to have done what he's done to secure the world. But I'm concerned he's retreating as a powerful force and leaving that to nations that really weren't involved in the conflict. So that NATO, the whole alliance of NATO, could be in jeopardy. Anyway, that's a lie.
It is a lot. I too agree that Prime Minister Carney is the right person in this exact moment. I mean, I don't know that we could have sort of found a better fit. It certainly was not by design. It was a choppy way that he found his way in there. But he's certainly resonating very well. And Is he more the politician that we're accustomed to, sort of right center down the line?
I think everybody governs from center.
Yeah.
And is he centrist? He's certainly more moving to center than his predecessor, who I think, in my opinion, made a lot of very damaging sort of impacts to the economy and our future prosperity with policy. But, you know, I think he is a little bit more centrist, maybe even right of center. We'll see. I mean, the goal is really diversification, reducing reliance. Policies will shift south of the border, and we can revisit those relationships. But today, to maintain stability, we've got to look for new partners and friends. And
yeah, and I certainly find that he's not easily distracted, which I really enjoy.
And quietly focused.
Yeah.
Like, he's not in front of the media or on Truth Social. He's just doing what needs to get done. He'll be measured at the polls at some point. But I think very humbly and quietly, we're making the progress we need to be.
It's a lesson in leadership, for sure, to watch him sort of enter this new world for him and sort of, as you say, quietly sort of navigate what is one of the most complex times in history. And yet, Canada seems to be doing okay in the moment. We have a lot more to do. There's a lot more.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that that speaks to at home, too, right? If we look at sort of what's happening politically and stuff like that, I think the Prime Minister sets a very interesting example for quiet, steady leadership. You know, that I always use the term a steady hand on the tiller, and that's such a, to me, it resonates so well with what's happening at the moment, right? We're not chopping back and forth, trying to get through this, right?
No, we're tacking where we need to tack.
Yeah.
But we're going in a direct line to an end result. And people seem to be, you know, Pierre Poilievre has been touring the States, vehemently opposed to the Liberal government.
Mm-hmm.
And his commentary recently is, look, we have to work together. We're going to support the Prime Minister. My job is to ensure the Canadians are taken care of. So there seems to be a different tenure of the relationship. And that could be Pierre Poilievre having to change his narrative because it wasn't working. He can't just be an angry opposition member. But I think there's more to it. I think there's an acknowledgement that we're facing an existential threat. We have to work together collaboratively, and Parliament seemed to be doing that. If we get the provincial legislature to work coherently together, that would be good too.
You clearly listened to Pierre Poilievre on the Joe Rogan podcast.
I did. We're podcasters.
Right.
We have to digest this material.
What did you think of that performance?
Performance, interesting term. I mean, he arranged this, and I thought it was very good. You know, people will have perceptions based on your, you know, preconceived notions of individuals. He is an articulate speaker. He's an orator. And I think he was sincere and, humble, maybe, is a word that wouldn't come out. But he was baited a couple of times by Joe Rogan to take some swipes, and he didn't. He restrained. He demonstrated leadership, which is, you know, what any opposition member has to do if you want to assert to that. But he's moved purposely from angry opposition to maybe leadership, but certainly collaborator. And I think that's what Canada needs today, is to work in unison to solve the problems that we're faced with.
Yeah, I thought he did. I thought he did well. I mean, and to the point of they were trying to bait him a little bit.
Yeah.
And I thought he did
what
he didn't take it at all. And I thought he did well there, which gave me a different perspective of him coming out the other end. I'm always fascinated by the comments I've been reading on social media about the Rogan Poilievre podcast, clearly by people who didn't listen to it, right? This is what bothers
me. Or you've got a preconceived perception.
Yeah.
It just perpetuates. You don't listen to it and digest it and make your own informed decision. You just continue with the rhetoric that you're accustomed to.
Yeah, now I just walked in here today, and you've had our leader of the opposition in here on the exchange.
Yeah.
Right? And the exchange drops what day? Here's a little plug for the exchange.
We appreciate that. Every Thursday.
Yeah.
So if you're watching this live today, there's a podcast coming out at noontime, which is probably out now. So we have, we looked at the future of Western PEI, and we've got two young men from Western PEI, Tyson Wilson and Daniel McDonald, both representing different regions of the West, Western PEI, talking about what they're doing today, what the future looks like. I'm comforted that we have a good future, and that people are we'll be in good hands if we can get through some of the challenges we're experiencing. But it's nice to see that there's young people, articulate, engaged, and wanting to make a commitment. So that drops every Thursday. And you mentioned we did just record the leader of Her Majesty's official opposition, Robert Mitchell. He was in, and we're certainly open to anybody. This is an opportunity to connect with Islanders. We've had other members of opposition in. The government are listening, and I hope they are.
Yep.
Maybe they're going to learn some policy things from our conversation. You're welcome to come on as well. Lots of things to talk about within government.
How did Robert do?
Robert is good. I mean, one of the challenges that I think Robert will acknowledge is he's outside the rail. Mm-hmm. So that affords him an opportunity to connect with Islanders and not be burdened by the theater, which really is what's happening inside the Legislative Assembly. I mean, they're doing work, but there's an hour, which is question period, which is theater. Afternoon theater, I call it. So he doesn't have to be part of that, but he misses the opportunity to make sound bites. Right. So to the extent that people are actually watching that, and aside from politicos, I don't know if anybody is, but he's able to connect to Islanders outside of the rail, and he's using that time effectively.
Yeah, connect with Islanders. I mean, you know, certainly from the outside looking in, not involved in any political party, he's very well received. When people talk about Robert Mitchell, they talk with respect, and sort of he's sort of that, has a nice common approach and a very down-to-earth, honest guy is a perception that I get when I talk to people and his name comes up. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, so I, as an observer, would have seen him in the House when he was representing Liberal governments, a couple of them, in fact. He's had ministerial portfolios. But I've had more interaction with him when he was outside of politics. So most recently, he was with the Lions Club.
Right.
And you see him at events. So he's kind of driven towards a vocation of helping, I think, and service to community.
Right.
He's jumped back into this political arena, maybe thinking there'd be an election soon when we had the Dennis King, Lance, Thompson, Lance government. I don't know if there's going to be an election in the current environment soon. So that changes the equation of entering and considering that offer of service. And, you know, he is, on a personal level, he's probably one of the nicest, most sincere politicians.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you look at the leader of the Green Party, a very intellectual, smart, capable individual. If you look at the leader of the Progressive Conservatives, Rob Lance, also considered to be very nice guys.
Yeah.
We've got all these competing personas, but how does that translate into effective action? I guess that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. They're good people in the mix. I mean, no doubt about it. Even the recent Progressive Conservative leadership race, I mean, you had Mark Ledwell and you had Premier Lance running against you. I mean, it's decent people.
And created,
decent ideas.
Created a lot of dialogue. So, that, in fact, you know, I think Robert Mitchell went through one of the largest, most successful leadership contest by percentages, won by a large margin. Whereas you look at the Progressive Conservatives, 7,000 members signed up.
Yeah.
Largest in any political party in the history of Prince Edward Island.
Yeah.
And it was a very competitive contest.
And of course, the other thing that I enjoyed about that whole thing was Boyce Thompson got the opportunity to be the premier. And Boyce is one of those guys that, I mean, perceived across the island as just a good, decent person.
Oh, no question. I know Boyce well. Unfortunately, he got involved in the political race, as his collegial MPLAs did. Probably not entirely appropriate
to
have people at that level, especially the sitting premier at the time, as Mr. Thompson was. But anyway, yeah, great guy. Maybe a questionable judgment in some cases, but all good people tend to gravitate toward the...
Right. One thing that I went to a couple of the leadership debates, and one thing that came out, particularly down in Montague, I guess it was, when they had their debate down there, was the ferry. Talk to me about the ferry. What are your thoughts on ferry running down there?
You know, we're kind of guaranteed constitutionally to have a continuous connection to the mainland. We have that now with a static bridge, which is great. It's reliable. It's available. It operates year-round, and as you can probably remember, prior to 1992, very often you'd be stuck at the terminal, maybe for days, certainly for many hours, waiting for the ice to break to get through. I've been stuck in the ice.
Yeah.
So to have that accessibility, it's crucial to the economy and access to healthcare off island. So it's a really great service. The reliability of the Northumberland ferries has been challenged. Mm-hmm. They've had a couple of really significant issues. It's disrupted service. There's been investment made. It's been delayed. So here we are today. We need to have that service connecting to our neighboring province in Nova Scotia. I know there's a vessel, there's been a lot of remediation done to ensure the new vessels can operate. Hopefully this summer, for all those that are employed and require that service, that's going to be available. And hopefully we don't get a tunnel that's going to displace that employment in that end of the island.
How does that company get the confidence of islanders back?
There's an issue. So if you have a business and you're relying on reliable, effective, timely transportation, and there's a constant disruption or instability in the service, that's a problem. Yeah. So I think they need to ensure that they've got a static schedule, that it goes on time. Just you don't want it to be like the train station of many years gone back, where you're looking at your watch wondering if it's going to come and if you missed it and when it's going to arrive. And I think they have been reliable operators. They've had a couple of hiccups. Really, it's been a difficult 2 or 3 years.
Right.
But they've got the pedigree and the history. And they don't just operate ferry service here. They offer it in other provinces, including the Yarmouth. And so they are good operators. They just need to have the right infrastructure, the right vessels.
Right. Of course, one of the vessels now being delayed and sort of caught up in shipbuilding conversation. Here's my big idea. Do you want to hear my big idea?
I always love big ideas.
Here's my big idea, right? So all this conversation around, and if anybody's listening, you can have this idea. It's fine. I don't need credit. Okay, this is fantastic. Oh, good. Okay. So here's my big idea. A lot of conversation right now around defense spending and things like that, and people trying to find.
You sure you want to release this? It's going to be a multi-million dollar.
I do want to release it because I'm more concerned about it moving forward than I am anybody sort of taking credit for it. And here's my big idea. The big idea is, with all this conversation going around defense spending and people trying to find their way in it, why not sort of create a ferry that has multiple uses?
That'd be great.
So here's what I'm talking about. So you take that ferry that runs down in the Northumberland Strait, and you kit it out with Canadian-made sonar systems, an example being Kraken Robotics out of Newfoundland that does a synthetic aperture sonar. You strap that on the side of that vessel, and that then allows that vessel to do surveys of the ocean floor. Now, those surveys could be used for coastal erosion. Those surveys could be used for monitoring critical infrastructure like power lines that might run beneath the ocean floor between Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick, right? And those had to be looked at so often. Or even, aside from sonar, even an ability to respond to disasters, humanitarian operation, disaster relief, things like that, where you could put things on that ferry, deploy that ferry to a part of Atlantic Canada or the Maritimes in the case of an emergency to deliver supplies and things like that. That creates a vessel then that is very appealing to the federal government to say that is not just a ferry that transports, that's a ferry that in an emergency we can use. It's a tool in our toolbox.
So it's an asset even for the defense.
It's an asset for defense. It's an asset for so many people. And it is a service that you can run. Now, to me, if you start talking like that, that puts that ferry build. It moves us up the schedule. It says all of a sudden, this is not just moving.
It's a priority for
it's a priority
funding release.
I would love to see something like that. To me, is sort of a little bit of thinking outside the box. Now, I know those guys that run the ferry service, they're all retired naval officers. Okay. They would get this, Canadian naval officers, they would get this immediately, and they would see the benefit in it.
So you're proposing this ferry service runs from, you know, two points in Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island. If you're going to look at the underwater cable, so this thing would have the ability to migrate to other areas. It's not just for transportation of people.
Well, if you look at the underwater cable, it's probably 40 nautical miles up the coast. And the ferry shuts down at midnight or whatever. I mean, it doesn't take much to take a run up, survey the cables, and come on back. And with the new technology, the cables can be surveyed in hours, not days.
Okay.
So all of a sudden now,
you're using an asset outside a regular serviceable hour.
100%. And even if it was a disaster or something like that, and you had to use it for serviceable hours, that's a very understandable thing.
Right.
That you're down to one ferry now because we're helping the good people of the Northern Peninsula of Newfoundland,
right,
for example, because there's a fire up there and we need to run water in there. We need to get things into those communities.
Yes. Yes.
Very real possibilities, right? And to me, this is the kind of thinking we need in the province of Prince Edward Island and say, huh, all of these things are happening.
And there's funding there that can support our infrastructure.
100%. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
And this is 100.
Yeah.
And this, so we've got a federal government that's looking for ways to increase defense spending,
yep,
trying to get to a 5% GDP number, right, in the next so many years. Wow.
We're using creative solutions to use the infrastructure that we have.
This is the type of thing that I think the province of Prince Edward Island should say, this is a homegrown solution. We can do this. And so, and that provides so many opportunities for academia to be in the conversation, mm-hmm, and say, how do we...
Well, business.
And business to be in. So all of these things, right, can play into this conversation. That's my big idea for today.
I like it.
I can give you a big idea every day.
I think we'll do that.
Yeah.
Every day we're here.
Every day, the big idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hope the engine doesn't run out. So if you want to talk about the big idea or any ideas, reminder again, you can give us a call. Our number is 902-500-500-2464. And we'd love to hear from you either by making a comment on the Facebook post or by giving us a call. And if people in the back office see comments that we miss because they tend to kind of disappear on the screen you're watching, please come let us know.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're throwing out some big topics here to try to entice people.
High level. Yes.
To try to entice people into the conversation. Well, and sometimes you've got to be a little controversial to get people into the conversation.
I like
so,
controversy.
How about the Leafs? What's going on there? First of all, just to stir up the conversation, I did not realize until last week or earlier this week that they had a professional hockey team.
Well, there you go. So, in fact, it's the most financially successful hockey team, maybe in all of sport, but certainly, I think, in the NHL. So if you look at the cities who have done best, New York, of course, they've got some teams that do very, very well, and Toronto. And that's because of corporate sponsorship. If you ever tried to get a ticket, you can understand why they're doing so well,
right,
despite the lack of success they tend to consistently have. But the big issue this week was the firing.
Right.
The GM, which I guess he's going back to Boston Pizza, maybe.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, I don't follow certainly the Toronto Maple Leafs or really the NHL for that matter. But I've always been fascinated by the Toronto Maple Leafs that they struggle so much, yet they have the most loyal fans. Of how do you round that? Why does that make sense?
Professional hockey in Canada. I mean, we've lost some teams like the Quebec Nordiques, and if you watched hockey last night, you would have seen their jerseys on the Colorado Avalanche, who put them on last night. Toronto is sort of the central Canadian team. Quebec had two teams. Now they've got one. The adversary is Montreal Canadiens, and then a couple out west. But there's such a large population in central Canada that Toronto just natively would become the preferred hockey team. And many people in the East Coast, of course, rooting for a 50 mission cap, maybe with
right,
Toronto getting back to some success.
But how do they keep the brand? How do they keep that? How do they keep their fans so loyal? When it goes back to that ferry conversation, right? Like, how does that company get people back again? I mean, they've lost some loyal. I love the ferry, so I'm one of those guys, and I'm not an Islander. I'm from Newfoundland, right? And so I understand why some Islanders struggle with the ferry. They've waited in ice like you. They've missed the boats. I understand all of that. But for a guy like me, there's no better way to come to Prince Edward Island than on the ferry.
You can think or read.
Well, it allows you to sort of decompress,
sure,
and appreciate the beauty of what you're about to enter,
yeah,
right? And that's what the ferry represents to me. It is just something so very special about Prince Edward Island, and the ferry to me is a part of that.
But if you're rushing to get aggregate from Nova Scotia to PEI,
yep,
or potatoes to the distribution market, or you have a business meeting in Halifax,
yep,
you need that.
You need a medical appointment, or yeah, I get it.
I mean, so I think many people, and unfortunately, until that trust is restored, they're going to look at their options and say, okay, it's an extra 45 minutes for me to get to the bridge, but I'm going to get across as long as wind conditions allow. Or I can go down east. It'll be on time. Maybe I won't know until I get there. I don't know. It's a challenge, and it is restoration of trust, I think, that it can down to.
Yeah. Well, and I wish them, you know, those lads are good guys that are running this right now.
It's and important infrastructure.
Yeah, and I wish them much luck. I have to tell you that, to me, when I travel on the ferry, and I do it often, when I travel on the ferry, I always try to engage people on the ferry. It's just, to me, such an incredible time to talk about Prince Edward Island. It's not very often that I travel on that ferry that you don't sort of direct somebody towards a good restaurant or a good place to visit or a good beach to go to. To me, it's just such an interesting part of Prince Edward Island. You got a caller coming in there now?
I'll let you talk for a minute and I'll just double check it here.
Yeah, so I mean, I wish those guys incredible luck down there, and I'm sure that they'll get it all back on track.
Do you want to be on the, I'm good. Did you? I'm going
to
just put you.
We got a caller coming in here now. I'm looking forward to that. Okay. We'll get that person on speaker there now.
Sure. Hold on. I've got to switch devices here, so bear with me. Alan can probably appreciate it. We've got to switch from glasses onto phone. I'm going to get you on speakerphone, and I'll get you, Chad, just to introduce yourself. And let us know why you're calling.
Oh, yeah, I'm Bill Bitten. I'm right out of Prince Edward Island. Right over here, you know, not too far. And I just have a good question for y'all. You know, with the rise of, you know, so many electrical grids and stuff, our world is becoming very focused on electrical. How are we not at risk of just being EMP with all of this, like everything, our entire infrastructure is based off of electrical grids, and EMPs have been around for a very long time. And in a time where, you know, war is kind of a touchy subject, how do we kind of protect ourselves in this world?
So I just want to confirm, you said it's Bill, and what community are you calling from?
Well, we're in Prince Edward Island, Canada.
Yeah, we're familiar with the area. Is there a certain place that you live in, a certain community in Prince Edward Island? Okay, well, we'll maintain that privacy. I guess, so what Bill is asking about is the reliance on... Do you want to define, I guess, Bill, what you're referring to as EMPs, so people know?
Well, an EMP, if you're not familiar, is an electrical magnetic pulse device. Easily
leave
in the dark for months at a time, you know.
Ah, I see. That's
it. In a place like Canada where it's like, I mean, I know most people can kind of survive off the land and stuff, but I mean, in those long winters where it's cold, you know, we need the power.
We do get some cold in PEI, and we do have, interestingly enough, I'll disconnect and we'll have this conversation. You can watch Bill online, but we do have people that are reliant on our energy grid, and it's fragile.
100%.
We're in a brownout situation frequently.
Yeah.
Any perspectives on that? I know there are alternate energy options that haven't been explored, and I think of cogeneration, for instance, as mm-hmm. one that would be a redundancy, at least, to the current electrical grid situation. Do you have any perspective?
You know, it's actually an interesting question, and it's a great one. I mean, we all know what it's like when the power goes out for a day or two, or the threat of it. It's a very complicated time, and it's something that we should focus on. But that's why I like sort of this conversation around building resiliency into what it is we're doing as Canadians. And that's a little bit about what this whole increase of 5% of our GDP going towards defense spending is all about. It's sort of how do we find our weak spots and sort of build resiliency into that. And that's a classic example because, well, I wouldn't say most of us rely on power, pretty much all of us. I mean, there's certain segments of Prince Edward Island, certain communities, the Amish and the like, that perhaps we could learn a little bit from on this particular front. But by and large, we're all sort of at mercy to it. But again, I go back to that. It's not even a device that he's talking about that might knock it all out. Just a ship dragging an anchor across those cables.
It's friction.
I mean, is going to cause us an awful lot of problems.
Right.
And this particular, great question.
Thanks very much, Bill. We'll continue the conversation.
For sure.
Appreciate the call.
Thank you, Bill.
So, you know, that part of that conversation is
we got a text in there, too.
Are we getting some action?
Listen, we're getting some action.
We might have to stay on all
it might have been the Maple Leafs conversation, right?
Well,
it's going to happen, right?
But on the electrical utility, I mean, we do have wind energy. We have solar energy. We've got electrical transmission from different sources, including a potential carbon-fired diesel energy generation facility on the Charlottetown waterfront. Maybe EMP is another option that we should be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I had a relationship with wind energy when I first moved to Prince Edward Island. Of course, you probably realize I ran my home off a 10-kilowatt turbine, and it was great while it lasted. But then
bearings failed,
and it was complicated to get a technician to fix it. And if you drive around Prince Edward Island now, you don't see many sort of smaller turbines up and operational, right? Which is unfortunate because we got a lot of wind here and it was creating great energy, but we just did, there was no sort of support system there for it.
And maybe the industry or the market is not large enough to support the infrastructure. If somebody in the back office sees some comments that they want to bring to us, I think I've lost it as I try to monitor that online, but good conversation. Energy security is a consideration for Islanders.
No, 100%. And it's something people should be concerned about because anything could happen at any moment. I mean, if you look at single points of failure, we got a lot of them, right?
So we have two cables, I think, today. One was cut, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe we've got three now. But we did have an incident a number of years ago where one cable was cut. And the population could be supported for a period of time until the repairs were made with a single cable. Today, 180,000 people demanding heat pumps and EVs and turning the lights on at supper time, we wouldn't last long with a single cable.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised, too. I think we have four cables. I'm not sure.
Okay, I knew we had invested.
I'm not sure what the status is. Okay. Maybe somebody from Fortis or Maritime Electric could let us know. I'm always amazed, really, at our power rates here on Prince Edward Island. You know, when I lived in Ontario, there was sort of you could use the devices in your home at certain hours, right, which would allow you to sort of have the best sort of rate.
Right. Run your laundry at nighttime.
Turn your. In fact, I remember when I lived in Ottawa, the Ontario government came out with an initiative that they could take charge of your heating and cooling system during the summer and drop your air conditioner down to save power. And in return for that, they gave you a whole bunch of energy efficient shower heads and all
light
of that
bulbs.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And light bulbs and stuff. But that didn't really entice me. But the thought of saying, well, I'm not there anyway.
Sure.
And, you know, in the 4 years that I lived in Ottawa, only twice did I come home and I said, geez, the house is awfully warm, right? And if they had sort of, it was written on the thing that
so
they had taken charge.
Because they have the infrastructure for net metering that we don't have here in PEI?
Yeah, I mean, they were clearly well set up for that in that particular jurisdiction and it worked well. But even, you know, even a simple thing of sort of reducing the rates and stuff to allow people when to use it and all that, I think that would help out an awful lot. You know, to our call yesterday around
affordability,
little steps like that could help so much, right? Right. And so where does that start, right? Well, Fortis or Maritime Electric are probably not going to start that initiative on their own.
To modernize, they have to.
Right. But maybe the provincial government says, okay, you know, we have contracts coming up here. We need you to sort of be more in line with sort of this. And so to me, that seems like a great example. But I'm glad he called in with that particular question. Yeah.
Well, and it does open up the dialogue for other concerns that Islanders are having on affordability. So when you look at the basket of things that are really causing stress to Islanders, we talked yesterday about food costs and medicine costs and energy costs, now gas pump, the impact.
Yeah.
So the cumulative compression of all these costs is really making life almost unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got small children that want to be involved in activities, you've got to make difficult decisions between are we going to have fresh vegetables this week, or are we going to participate in an event so our children can be exposed to things? Really challenging time, I think, for many Islanders.
Right. But again, I mean, so a lot of these things, right, you know, and I this show, in my mind, is fashioned after a great program in Newfoundland called the Open Line Show.
In Ontario, I think.
But I'm more familiar with the Newfoundland one. I was always frustrated. People call in, the government needs to do more, the government needs to do more. I mean, there's only so much they can do.
And we are the government.
And we are the government, yeah.
We elect people who represent yeah. us, and they should be reflective of what we want.
All right.
So, yeah, I think we want to have a dialogue to find solutions. And I think Islanders have solutions. We want you to give us those. We still have time left. Let me give you that number again if you want to call in. It's 902-500-2464. Just identify yourself, the community you're from, and what you want to talk about.
Yeah, and it's also a great opportunity for our political leaders or industry leaders to call in and give us their perspective on things, right? This is a place where your voice can be heard. And
it's a safe space.
And we're not here to sort of poke holes in your argument. I mean, we'll ask questions, but at the end of the day, get your voice out there, and this is a great mechanism to connect directly with people of Prince Edward Island or people that are concerned about what's going on in Prince Edward Island. And it's a great show, and congratulations for not only this, but your other podcasts that you have.
Well, so in a vacuum of activity, one's left to create opportunity, and there's not much opportunity, but it's a great vehicle to allow Islanders to have a voice and connect to media in a different, more flexible format. So we have the Business Edge podcast. We've got the Exchange podcast. We'd welcome other contributors who want to be part of our podcast network to come and be part of it. And we've got some infrastructure. I think collectively, if we can create a community space
right.
where people from different perspectives and different levels of interest and different subjects can connect with Islanders. That's what the goal of this is.
100%. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of topics that can be sort of that are worthy of their own conversation.
Like the Leafs.
Like the Leafs, for example. But on the sports thing, right? I mean, sports are great. A lot of Islanders are very passionate about it. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have an all sports sort of hour conversation where people can call in and voice their concerns? Another call coming in, the last one for the day. We'll take that caller now.
Hi there, you are on the podcast. Did you want to connect and share your thoughts? Hold on 1 second, I'll put you on speakerphone. You should be live now if you just want to introduce yourself and tell us what you'd like to talk about.
Daniel McDonald, Glengarry.
Glen, the metropolis of Glengarry. Interestingly enough,
yes,
I think
sir.
Daniel McDonald is on our podcast, The Exchange, today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What's on your mind, Daniel?
Well, I listened yesterday, and I was going to listen again today, but we just, our fuel truck driver come to deliver farm fuel today, so I went out to chat with him for a little bit.
Daniel, we have good news. We also, while we broadcast this live on Facebook for people who want to tune in and call directly, it's also on YouTube. And if you go to our website, theislanddew.com, you'll find it there. You can listen to it over and over.
There you go.
Put yourself to sleep at night, so it's there.
I wouldn't say that.
So what's on your mind, Daniel?
We can store roughly 3,000 liters of fuel here, and I got 1,000 liters today, $2,464.
Wow.
So how much was it the last time you filled it up? Not that much. So you're 2,400?
No.
Significant increase.
Very large.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something now that we just have to absorb.
And maybe just tell people what your background is, because I know from our podcast, but what is the impact to you and your industry through these fuel price increases?
Well, we have a dairy farm and a beef farm, so we ship our milk to ADL. It gets picked up every second day, and our feedlot, we ship finished cattle to Atlantic Beef Products and supply some local markets. So, like, our prices, we can't fluctuate our prices with, the increases in fuel or the increases in any input cost.
So, it's interesting. So, your input cost, and let's say energy is maybe one of the more significant ones, you don't have much control over it, but you're in some markets that are regulated. So, your price is fixed. You can't really pass that on to your consumer. So, you just absorb that. And at what point does it become questionably feasible to continue to supply, the fresh produce and services that Islanders want?
that's hard to say. Like, you know, this is, you know, this is a new time for this for me. Like, you know, I asked the fuel truck driver, I said, what's the most that, you know, he ever seen the cost of dyed diesel? And he said this was the highest he's ever seen at $2.11 a liter. And when he started to sell fuel, he was selling it for 27 cents a liter.
Oh, my.
It's a big difference.
Wow.
So, Dan, what's the solution? Do you have any suggestions on how we...
I don't know. And I listened a little bit yesterday there when you were speaking on IRAC and, you know, regulating maritime electric and stuff. And I was going to call in yesterday, but I didn't. After Hurricane Fiona, we had no electricity here for 7 days. And with dairy cattle or with any livestock, you have to have ventilation and barns. And so we ran a tractor and generator for 7 days straight. And it cost us $984 in diesel fuel to produce electricity for 7 days for the farm. So when you receive the electricity bill from Maritime Electric, it's, you know, a lot less than that. So, like, you know, we should be grateful that somebody else will produce power or electricity for us at a much cheaper rate than we ourselves can try to produce it for.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting perspective, isn't it? People, including us, we don't criticize, but we acknowledge the costs that go into things like electrical generation. But if we didn't have that service...
I never complained about the Maritime Electric bill because I know what it costs for me to try to produce power, and I can't come close to producing it cheaper than they can deliver it for.
That's a great perspective.
It's a great perspective,
and
yeah.
Not one that we hear too often.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, that's really good evidence on the importance of the reliability of a distributor.
Daniel, I have a question for you. Oftentimes in cases of disasters and big global events, governments sort of lean in and subsidize to help out critical industries to sort of stay afloat. Do you see what we're going through right now with fuel prices as being at that point yet?
I think they could and perhaps should step in, and, you know, because, like, you know, we're no different than, you know, any other household. You only have so much money to work with, and, you know, to be able to shell out additional, you know, dollars to try to survive or produce whatever you're doing, you know, it's a struggle and a challenge. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, it's not my fault the cost of fuel is what it is today. Like, you know, I didn't initiate anything to drive that price of the product up, so it, you know, puts the consumer at a disadvantage when, you know, they have no control over, you know, and I can't shut the tractor off. Like, you know, we have to feed the cattle, and we have to milk the cows, and we have to do all these things on a daily basis, and there's just no cutting corners to do it. So if government could step in and provide relief, you know, by all means do it, and, you know, should be done fairly soon, because, you know, everybody was kind of, or they talked that they were at the breaking point before, and, well, I think we're past that now, for sure.
Daniel, you bring up a very, very good point, and your perspective is very much appreciated.
No problem.
Thank you for the call.
Now, that's the reason.
Thanks, Daniel.
That's the reason why this thing exists, right? So, here's a guy out there responsible for putting the milk on the table, for putting beef in the on the table. And I want to tell you, like, you hear from this guy, he is feeling the pinch, and no one is sort of helping him out. And he doesn't have much choice, right?
What do you do? Yeah.
Yeah, so this is why a conversation like this is so important, Blake, is that now there's the opportunity to get a perspective from, politicians and stuff, like what they're thinking, how they can help. And if they don't understand what's going on, now they're getting it.
Right.
They're getting it right there, right?
You know, this agriculture industry is a primary industry. It's one of our most important industries in PEI. And you're right. If we don't know where our food's coming from locally, we have a concern. Those kind of fixed input costs that can't be passed on or absorbed by the producer, that's not sustainable.
No.
And we talked yesterday about the futures of oil and how that pricing schedule works. the price of fuel is probably not coming down. We're coming into the highest consumption period of fuel, which is sort of the travel season in June. The contracts, forward contracts that you see on the commodity indexes are for that same time period. I'm afraid for Daniel and others, this price is really not going to be adjusted. We're probably going to have to accept it. This is one of the challenges that Iraq have to address. And we comment, and people comment often about the electrical utility, the regulator, which is Iraq, but it's a very complex issue.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you ensure that the primary sector producers are respected and protected and maintain operation? Because the loss of that, which is a possibility, is far worse than the consequence of providing supports.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, I'm so pleased that we received that call here at the end of the show today. What a great conversation today, Blake. I mean, we covered a lot of stuff. We covered everything from President Trump right there, our prime minister, opposition. We talked political parties, talked about defense spending. We gave some big ideas around theories. We even talked a little bit about the Leafs.
Well, all good subjects, and probably subjects that will resonate into our next program. Now, we have a long weekend coming up. So we'll be off until next week.
Okay.
Watch our Island Do, theislanddo.com, to get an update on when we'll be back. But we should be back on Tuesday, I assume.
We'll be back around then, for sure.
Excellent. Well, thanks everybody who tuned in and listened. Again, you can find us, if you're online now, at our website. We're also on YouTube. And really appreciate Alan Dale, his perspectives, and he's a great co-host. Delighted to have you here, and thanks for everything, and thanks for the callers.
Real pleasure. Thanks, everybody.